You're listening to KRML, 1410 AM. News Network is next.
This is the Quality News Network. British investigators are questioning at least 8 people, 6 of whom are medical personnel, in connection with a suspected Al-Qaeda plot to detonate car bombs in London and Scotland. In Australia, the BBC is reporting that 2 doctors are being detained for questioning in connection with those failed plots, one as he tried to leave the country. Neither has been arrested. No charges have been filed. In Glasgow, a bomb disposal team conducted a controlled explosion on a vehicle discovered near a mosque. London's Heathrow Airport Terminal 4 was evacuated today as security inspects what they are calling a suspicious bag. Authorities are keeping the threat level across Britain at critical. Passengers are undergoing secondary searches before being allowed to board outbound flights. Congressional Democrats are swiftly condemning President Bush for commuting the prison sentence of a former aide to Vice President Cheney. Louis Scooter Libby won't serve any time in prison after being convicted and sentenced to 2.5 years for perjury and obstruction of justice. Senator Harry Reid of Nevada called the commuted sentence disgraceful, while Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont said it was, quote, emblematic of a White House that sees itself as being above the law, unquote. Libby's conviction still stands, as does a court-ordered fine of $250,000 and 2 years probation. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's cabinet has approved a draft of a key oil law which will define distribution of the country's oil revenues. Debate could begin on its approval as soon as tomorrow. Pakistani security forces fought gun battles with students from a pro-Taliban mosque in the center of Islamabad today, killing 1 paramilitary soldier and 2 students. President Musharraf is facing mounting criticism over his failure to crack down on Red Mosque campaign to enforce conservative law. Japan's defense minister resigned his job after making remarks that appeared to accept the 1945 atomic bomb attacks on Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Japan's first female defense minister will be sworn in tomorrow as his replacement. Opera megastar Beverly Sills has passed away in New York at the age of 78. A look at science and business news just ahead. Now this.
Terry's Lounge at the Cypress Inn in downtown Carmel invites you to a great evening of your favorite foods, beverages, and live music Thursday through Saturday, featuring Dick Whittington and friends from 6 to 9:30. Terry's Lounge in the Cypress Inn features an appetizer-sized menu and our famous burger, salad, and fries. Afternoon tea, a great local tradition, is served from 1 to 4 p.m. daily by reservation. Sunday evenings are special as Richard Dibnick entertains from 5 to 8 p.m. with classical renditions of pop, jazz, and classical music. Join the fun, food, and music at Terry's Lounge in the Cypress Inn, corner of Lincoln and 7th. In downtown Carmel.
NASA's space shuttle Endeavour is one step closer to an August launch date. Endeavour moved from its hangar at the Kennedy Space Center to the Vehicle Assembly Building, where it'll be outfitted with its external fuel tank and solid rocket boosters, and then it's on to a nearby launch pad by next Monday. Difficulty identifying common smells like lemon, cinnamon, or banana could be a first sign of Alzheimer's. Research scientists in Chicago found that those adults who made at least 4 errors on an odor test were 50% more likely to develop problems with memory and thinking down the road. The U.S. economy appears to be gaining ground, and with progress comes the threat of inflation. A Wall Street Journal survey of 60 economists reflects the outlook of the U.S. Federal Reserve. Most financial experts surveyed said they don't expect a cut in interest rates this year. Many see the central bank cutting its base from 5.25% to 5% by June of next year. The U.S. dollar fell to a 26-year low against the British pound. That was ahead of an expected rate hike by the Bank of England later this month. With the recent lucrative sale of its wealth management subsidiary, a Charles Schwab Corporation will distribute $3.5 billion to its stockholders. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 45 points at 13,737.
This is a top to a, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
the
and
amps 11. Go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn Conversation Radio into Conservation Radio. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions of Sydney, Australia, and the Mid-Atlantic Regional Council of Carpenters. They're building the American dream every day. B1 Louder by ringing 877-443-2366. That's 877, the numeral 4, head on. And now, your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox!
Well, all right, everybody. Welcome aboard Foxed Up here for a Tuesday morning. Yeah, it's Tuesday morning. That's what it is. It's Tuesday morning. It's Wednesday morning here, but that really gets things confusing. But, we're still live! Can you believe it? 2 days in a row. It's amazing. I still have bandwidth. We'll see what happens the next time it rains, but hey, what are you going to do? You know, not much has changed since yesterday aside, you know, I mean, nothing's changed. You know, the Bush administration is still a bunch of crooks. We just keep finding out more about it. But we're going to get back to kind of normal programming, but with a little bit of a twist today. I was heading into the city this morning, and over the last couple of days, I pulled out a book that I started reading a couple months ago and got sidetracked, so I had to start over. And this book is absolutely amazing, and the book I'm speaking of is The Weathermakers, The History and Future Impact of Climate Change by the current Australian of the Year, Mr. Tim Flannery. Now, Tim is a scientist, he's an explorer, he's an amazing writer, I mean, unbelievably eloquent. I mean, this book, aside from being jam-packed with incredible information, is unbelievably poetic. And I'm coming home on the train tonight, and like I said, I've just restarted the book, and I get into chapter 4, and I almost missed my stop getting off, you know, to get home, because I just got engrossed, and it's not very long. I'm actually going to read the chapter. This is probably going to be the show today. And if nothing else, I hope it makes you go out and buy this book, and you can order it from Amazon on today's show post, in fact. Anyway, I think that this book is going to become as important to me as The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight from Tom Hartman is just being an easily read yet just incredibly packed writing of the state of our planet. And what makes this book particularly interesting is the history. And, you know, here we are, you know, 21st century human beings, and you know, we're all on reading up on the science of climate change and everything, and we keep thinking that, you know, this is something that was, you know, began to be really realized in the 70s, and we're really waking up to it in mass now, and, you know, maybe back to the 50s that some people were, you know, paying attention, you know, considering themselves, you know, on the cusp and you know, early in on the game. But this chapter made me realize, or made me understand, how far back the understanding of man's impact on our planet, you know, goes back. And it's just it's amazing. Now, the title of the chapter is "The Sages and the Onion Skin." It just gives you an idea of the way that this thing is written. And it opens up with a quote from Arvid Gustav Hugeboom. And I believe this was a Swedish scientist. And he says, "A simple calculation shows that the temperature in the Arctic regions would rise about 8 to 9 degrees centigrade if the carbonic acid, being CO2, increased 2.5 or 3 times its present value. The world's present production of coal reaches, in round numbers, to 500 millions of tons per annum, or 1 ton per square kilometer of the Earth's surface. This was in 1894. All right. And that sounds like a lot. You know, 1 ton per square kilometer. Now, we're way beyond that. We're way beyond that. Now, as I was reading this, I kept, you know, kind of flipping back, you know, a couple of paragraphs or a page and rereading, and just being, I was just amazed that there were people that had a scientific understanding of these concepts of the greenhouse effect, and that they were chasing up the concept, well, not the concept, but the triggers of an ice, and relating it to carbon. Just absolutely astounded by this. Now, I'm going to wait until we come back from the break to actually get into this. If you want to check out more on Tim Flannery, you can go to theweathermakers.com, and it's got his bio and his other books. He's written about over 100 peer-reviewed papers. This guy really is the real deal when it comes to climate science. And he comes off as an amazingly how does one say? Nice guy, for one. He's been savagely attacked recently by the New South Wales treasurer, Michael Costa, who is an idiot. He's a known climate change skeptic, and he actually called Flannery an idiot and a fool. And to me, that is only just proves how stupid Michael Costa is. because he obviously is just someone who's an absolute just denier of what is happening right here, right now. So we're going to go out to our first break here on this Tuesday morning. When we come back, I'm going to start reading from this book, and so it's going to be Foxy's Book Corner, or, you know, I don't know, book club, whatever. We don't have any music for it. But anyway, when we come back, we're going to do that, and sometime later, I've got today's track of the day as well, which was sent in by Mr. Billy Shears. So stick with us. You're listening to Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network, America's Liberal Voice, and we'll be right back with The Weathermakers.
This is Bill O'Brien with a message that pretty much defines Concord University. It's from Emily Dickinson. There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away, nor any courses like a page of prancing poetry. This traverse may the poorest take without oppressive toll. How frugal is the chariot that bears a human soul. Respect for learning, a mission to deliver education that touches souls, consideration to what students can afford, career rewards that pay dividends far beyond the dollars earned. At Concord, we've never crossed that important line between the business of education and education as a business. The first is extremely serious. It changes lives and connects with the moral and the spiritual. We're good at that. The second is no less serious. It raises ethical concerns, however. We avoid that. Concord University, the frugal chariot that bears human souls. Call the Concord Admissions Office, 1-888-384-5249. I can see.
And again, I was talking about the Republican debate. So we'll get to the point where we're going to drag a terrorist out to the stage with the Republicans, and they're all going to take turns kicking him in the nuts and see who the audience cheers for the most. That's going to determine who's going to be the Republican candidate. And that's what they are. Kick him in the nuts. How do they do that on South Park? Rochambeau. They're going to Rochambeau the terrorists.
Come on, rub my nipples while I torture this little piggy.
Now that sounds pretty sweet to me.
The Cup of Joe radio show with your host, the working man's thinking man, Joe Vecchio. 11 a.m. to noon weekdays here on the Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice.
Howdy, this is Baxter Black, and if you're like me, you're concerned that the environment we enjoy today may not be around for our children and grandchildren. All the new technology in the world can't create more sky over our heads or new oceans. The Earth's natural resources, fresh water, land, and even the air we breathe are limited. Voluntary family planning improves the health of women and their children. It also helps slow population growth, which is good for our planet. So help ensure that people everywhere have access to the information and services they need to plan their families and help build a healthy future for us all. Population Action International is working to promote voluntary family planning around the world. Visit us at www.populationaction.org. That's populationaction.org.
This is the Head On Radio Network.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to Fox Up here on the Head On Radio Network. And today we're going to have a little bit of a reading from Tim Flannery's The Weathermakers. And it's not a long chapter, but I found this incredibly fascinating. And please forgive me when we get to some of the old English. When I stumble, trip, don't make fun of me. I'll make fun of me. I want to hear you anyway. But get through it, and I hope you get the gist of why I'm going to go through this exercise. So from the chapter "The Sages and the Onion Skin," the 20th century opened upon a greatly altered world. Charles Darwin was 18 years in the grave. Gregor Mendel's pioneering studies into genetic inheritance were about to be rediscovered, and the horse was nearing the end of its tenure as humanity's principal source of transport. Yet one relic of a heroic earlier age remained. In his eighth decade of life, Alfred Russel Wallace was still writing with as much energy and vision as ever. Indeed, when he passed away on the eve of the Great War, age 90, his obituary notice proclaimed that he laid aside his pen only to die. Of all the productions of his twilight years, none rivaled the monumental work that marked his 80th year, Man's Place in the Universe. It's a lucid yet idiosyncratic book which attempts to demonstrate that mankind is the pinnacle, the center, literally the reason for the existence of everything. Its central thrust, along with an attachment to spiritualism
and a determined rejection of the benefits of immunization caused Wallace to be seen as a heretic in an increasingly orthodox scientific world. And yet, for all its foibles, man's place in the universe is full of insights that resonate with an environmental aware 21st century. What makes the book so percipient is the author's integrated, holistic way of thinking. It's a similar approach to that of James Lovelock and his Gaia theory. As was Lovelock, Wallace was struck with the realization that even slight variations in existing conditions could make Earth uninhabitable. This observation became the book's refrain, that the foul effusions of the Industrial Revolution threaten humanity. As the octogenarian warmed to his subject, so too did his blood rise. "Let everything give way to this," he rails, as he rallies all humanity to fight the polluters. As in a war of conquest or aggression, nothing is allowed to stand in the way of victory. Wallace was not the first to condemn air pollution, nor the first to foresee its many dangers. Fumifugium, or the inconvenience of air smoke of London dissipated, together with some remedies, humbly proposed, how's that for a title, was published by the English writer John Evelyn in 1661. As Evelyn pointed out, even at that early date, so vile were the effusions of coal-burning fires that they could be smelled from miles away. London, he wrote, resembled the suburbs of hell. A few decades later, Timothy Norris published an essay on London's air in which he wrote that the vapors were eating the city alive, leaving its oldest buildings peeled and flayed, as I may say, to the very bones by this hellish and subterraneous fume. John Grant, a London draper, who in 1662 compiled the first methodical analysis of London's mortality records, was also concerned. Grant had nothing to rely on but the records of ancient matrons who bore the onerous responsibility of inspecting all corpses in the city and reporting on the cause of death. Many of the diagnoses are, from today's perspective, incomprehensible. Perhaps they even puzzled Grant. For among causes given are affrighted, grief, itch, piles, planet, raising the lights, and mother. The latest cause of death, or the last cause of death, relates to a belief widely held in the 17th century that the organs of the body were rather like the inhabitants of a village. If they were unhappy, they could revolt and wander off in search of a better situation. The womb was thought to be particularly liable to upset. If it got too much sex, or perhaps not enough, it was likely to take umbrage and wander towards the neck. Hey, I lost my spot. Don't you hate when that happens? There it would cause shortness of breath or even suffocation. A favored cure for any woman suffering from mother was to affix a foul-smelling sponge to her suffocating mouth and a sweet-smelling one to her nether regions to entice the womb back into position. Today, both rising the lights being lungs, and mother would be described as diseases of the lungs, and it was the matron's reports were enough for Grant to assert what had been obvious to the public for centuries. Lung disorders were a leading cause of death in the metropolis, far more than in the countryside, and the cause lay with the city's appalling coal-fueled pollution. Frighteningly, little improvement was made to the quality of London's air until after World War II. Indeed, by the time of the Great Smog of 1952, which killed 12,000, many Londoners had developed a perverse pride in their city's filthy air. But Wallace was different. He was apoplectic at the way it stunted and sickened young growing bodies, yet his concerns went far beyond that, and he could understand the invisible effects that burning all the coal was having on the systems that keep Earth habitable. A century before Wallace drew his first breath, the brilliant French mathematician Jean-Baptiste Ferrier was struggling to establish what determines the average temperature of the Earth's surface. He wondered why the planet didn't just keep heating up as it was struck by sunlight until it became as hot as the sun itself. The answer lay in heat radiation, which carries energy back into space at a rate that, in a cosmic sense, balances Earth's books, the result being the average temperature of our planet. But as he calculated the balance between incoming energy from the sun and outgoing radiation, he kept getting nonsense results. His workings showed that Earth would be an ice block, frozen solid at minus 15 degrees centigrade below zero. Then, in a flash of inspiration, Ferrier realized that his calculations on heat energy were correct, but that not all of the heat was escaping into space. Something within the atmosphere, he realized, must be keeping heat in. He envisaged that the atmosphere was acting like a glass in a hothouse, letting sunlight in without interference, but then trapping the heat that the sun's rays generate on reaching the ground. The greenhouse effect. I mean, think about that. I mean, I just think that this is outstanding. Today we can explain Ferrier's observations thus. The sun is a very powerful energy source, and the more powerful the source, the shorter the wavelengths of energy generated. Most of the sun's light energy is very short in wavelength. Visible light ranges from 400 nanometers to 700 nanometers. And at this wavelength, energy passes through the atmosphere without warming it. This, along with another important principle, can be demonstrated by visiting a ski field. There, the air remains cold on a sunny day, both because the sun does not warm the atmosphere, and there is little water vapor in the cold air to trap any heat, and because the sun's energy is reflected back to space by the snow. When the sun's rays fall on a darker body, such as skin or a ski glove, however, the rays are absorbed and heat is generated. As your ski glove warms to a toastiness greater than its surrounds, the heat energy, which has much longer wavelengths than sunlight, is radiated back to the sky, where it is captured by the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and so light passes harmlessly through the atmosphere charged with greenhouse gases, but heat has trouble getting out. All right, I'm going to hold there because we're going to head off to this break. But I mean, we're seeing you know, intelligent people as far back as 1660. So, you know, when you have some denier jackass come up to you and say this is just newfangled hoo-ha, show them, just have them read this chapter. No. This is well established. This has been around for a long time, and we just keep learning more and more about it. I find this fascinating. So stick around. Might be a little bit early to go to the break, but I figure that's a good place to take a pause there, Bob. That's all right. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to continue on with this reading from the Weathermakers. I'm kind of making it through without too many stumbles, so it's a tricky read. So stick around, folks. You're listening to Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network, and we will be right back after this.
Forage in the forest like a primate, using chopping tools instead of hot plates.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Huh?
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view. After the Supreme Court's last term, it's hard to find much solace on that bench. Bush, Cheney, and Rove have gotten what they wanted. Pat Robertson and James Dobson have gotten what they wanted. And the Chamber of Commerce and the National Association of Manufacturers all cashed in. Of all the arguments against voting for third-party or independent candidates, the Supreme Court one has always been the hardest to deal with, and it just got harder. But let me clutch at a straw here. After the court had announced all its decisions, it made one more announcement. It had changed its mind on a crucial matter. Months ago, it turned down an appeal by detainees at Guantanamo, but now it's agreed to hear that case. My hope is that Justice Kennedy, the swing vote all term, has finally been persuaded by the liberals on the court that the Military Commissions Act is unconstitutional, which it clearly is. It doesn't even allow judicial oversight of detainee designations. And if only on institutional grounds to protect the court's domain, Kennedy may have come around finally. I'm reaching here, I know. But with this court, we can only hope for Justice Kennedy and for the continued health of Justice Stevens, Souter, Breyer, and Ginsburg. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
Recently on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
If you have tuned into this program by mistake right now, and you are a Republican, a right-wing Republican specifically, before this program is over, I do want to warn you, you're going to think that I'm the devil. You're going to think I've got horns and a red cape because I hate the Bush administration and everything they stand for. So be warned right away, okay? You're all warned right now that that's where we're coming from today.
Don't miss Guy James, weekdays, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, on the Head On Radio Network.
This is The Horn, the Head On Radio Network.
Welcome back to Foxed Up, everybody. All right. It's Foxy's Book Club today, and we're reading from the Weathermakers from Australian of the Year, Tim Flannery. And we're already kind of halfway through this little chapter here, The Sages and the Onion Skin, just showing how far back the concept of climate science goes. So... continuing on after, you know, Ferrier basically coming up with the concept of the greenhouse, of, you know, the effect of greenhouse. It says, for almost 70 years, little was made of Ferrier's observations. Then Svante Arrhenius, a Swedish chemist who received a Nobel Prize in 1903, decided to investigate the matter further. In the mid-1890s, around the time he undertook the work, the Swede was suffering a marriage breakup. Desperate for an escape from what must have been a truly unhappy situation, Arrhenius spent up to 14 hours a day for a year in repetitive, mind-numbing calculations. These he had undertaken at the behest of some friends, including the geologist Gustav Hogeboom, who I quoted at the top of this, who were obsessed with one of the great questions of the day: what had caused ice ages?
It was a mystery that had gripped the imagination ever since Louis Agassiz proved that much of Europe and North America had once been covered by glacial ice. Back then, mammoth, giant deer, and woolly rhinos trudged a landscape where fields of wheat now grew. The transformation had clearly been a grand one, and whoever could take the victor's wreath by explaining how the change occurred would be assured of enduring scientific fame. Arrhenius had been was able to demonstrate that a reduction of CO2 in the atmosphere could have brought on an ice age. But more importantly, for our purposes, he speculated on how CO2 levels might influence the Earth in the future. He thought that at 19th century rates of coal burning, the amount of atmospheric CO2 might double in 3,000 years, bringing balmy conditions to Sweden. This he approved of, thinking only that the process was a little too slow and that might be hastened by burning more coal. Despite the attraction that may have held for Scandinavians and others afflicted by hard winters, his ideas were soon forgotten. Yet quietly and without a systematic plan, industry was performing Arrhenius's bidding and increasing the amount of coal burned. Regardless of these advances, climatologists seemed uninterested in the role greenhouse gases play in determining climate. Then in 1938, a steam engineer named Guy Callender addressed the Royal Meteorological Society in London on the subject. Callender had an amateur interest in climate trends, and his thorough compilation of statistics, he believed, correctly as it turned out, showed that the world was warming. Moreover, he announced that he knew the cause, the burning of coal and other fossil fuels in industrial machines. Unfortunately, Callender's prescient study was dismissed by the academics as a dabbling of an amateur, and soon after, the warming trend went into reverse, bringing a temporary end to this line of inquiry. Around a quarter of a century before Callender addressed the Royal Meteorological Society, a remarkable reversal of fortune was to lead another climate pioneer to a grand discovery. Milutin Milankovitch had spent most of his career practicing as a civil engineer in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Born in what is now Serbia, in 1909 he abandoned his construction work to take up an academic appointment in Belgrade. Soon, however, the turbulent events of the Balkan Wars and then World War I intervened, and Milankovitch was interned in Budapest, where he was allowed to work in the library of the Hungarian Academy of Sciences. He had already begun to ponder on that great puzzle of his time, the cause of ice ages. And his internment provided an opportunity to pursue it with a single-mindedness that civilian life could not offer. By the end of the war, he completed a monograph on some aspects of the problem, thus forming a base to what he added over the following decades. In 1941, with the world embroiled in yet another global conflict, Milankovitch was finally ready to publish his great work, Canon of Insulation of the Ice Age Problem. Milankovitch identified three principal cycles that drive Earth's climatic variability. The longest of the cycle concerns the planet's orbit around the Sun. Surprisingly, perhaps, Earth's orbit does not describe a perfect circle, but an ellipse whose shape changes on a 100,000-year cycle known as Earth's eccentricity. When Earth's orbit is strongly elliptical, the planet is carried both closer to and further away from the Sun, meaning that the intensity of the Sun's rays reaching the Earth varies considerably throughout the year. At present, the orbit is not very elliptical, and there is only a 6% difference between January and July in the radiation reaching the Earth. At times when the Earth's orbit is at its most eccentric, however, that difference is 20 to 30%. This is the only cycle that changes the total amount of the Sun's energy reaching the Earth, so its influence is considerable. The second cycle takes 42,000 years to run its course, and it concerns the tilt of Earth on its axis. This varies from 21.8 to 24.4 degrees, and it determines where the most radiation will fall. At the moment, the Earth's axial tilt is in the middle of its range. The third and shortest cycle, which runs its course every 22,000 years, concerns the wobble of the Earth on its axis. You didn't really think that the Earth wobbled, did you? But it does. during the course of this cycle, the Earth's axis shifts from pointing to the pole star to pointing at Vega. This affects the intensity of the seasons. When Vega marks true north, winters can be bitterly cold and summers scorchingly hot. Only when continental drift brings large parts of the Earth's land surface near the poles can Milankovitch's cycles cause ice ages. Then, when the cycles are right, mild summers and harsh winters allow snow to accumulate on the pole lands until finally it builds into great ice domes. Even at their most extreme, his cycles bring an annual variation in the total amount of sunlight reaching Earth of less than 0.1%. Yet that seemingly trivial difference can cause the Earth's temperatures to rise or fall by a whopping 5 degrees centigrade. How such small inputs result in such big changes remains a profound mystery, but it is certain that greenhouse gases play a role. Indeed, computer models cannot simulate the onset of an ice age unless atmospheric CO2 is reduced in the southern hemisphere. Milankovitch's canon solved the riddle of the ice ages, but because he published it in Serbian, it was decades before the world learned of his brilliance. By the time the work was translated into English in 1969, oceanographers had begun to discern, in sediments drawn from the deep ocean floor, empirical evidence of exactly the kind of impacts he had predicted. Today, Milankovitch's masterwork is regarded as one of the greatest breakthroughs ever made in climate studies. With an understanding of greenhouse gases and Milankovitch's cycles under their belts, climatologists were on their way to grasping why Earth's climate had varied over time. Yet there are still other factors to consider. One is the intensity of radiation emitted from the sun. About two-thirds of the sun's rays reaching our planet are absorbed and put to work here, while the remaining third is reflected back into space. It is those captured rays that power our weather and climate, and most life on Earth. Evidence that the sun is not an unvarying fiery globe has been with us for a long time. Over 2,000 years ago, Greek and Chinese astronomers wrote of seeing dark spots in the sun whose shape and location changed. In April 1612, Galileo, armed with one of the first telescopes, made detailed observations of these sunspots, demonstrating that they were not satellites passing across the surface of the sun, but that they originate from the star itself. As it happened, Galileo's death in 1642 coincided with a period of exceptionally low sunspot activity which lasted for several centuries, and which may have led to both cold temperatures in Europe and a lack of interest in the phenomenon. In the 19th century, serious study of sunspots resumed, and it was discovered that their activity varied on an 11-year cycle, as well as on a longer cycle of centuries. Sunspots are slightly cooler than the rest of the sun's surface, yet when there are lots of them, Earth paradoxically seems to warm up. A scarcity of sunspots is thought to account for around 40% of the temperature decrease experienced during the so-called Maunder Minimum of 1645 to 1715. During this period, Europe's temperature plummeted, causing the Thames and the Dutch Zuiderzee regularly to freeze. The role that sunspots have played in these changes, however, is still challenged by some, for despite the coincidence in timing, no testable physical mechanism has yet identified which would allow sunspots to affect the temperature of our planet. Scientists recently acknowledged that variations in solar radiation and greenhouse gas concentrations affect Earth's climate in fundamentally different ways. Now, this is where it gets interesting when it comes to the folks who are climate change deniers. And for anyone who has seen this this bogus doco, the global warming swindle, this is what they're relying on. And Mr. Flannery, in one paragraph, blows the doors off the logic. Continuing on how the solar radiation affects in different ways. This is because solar radiation warms the upper levels of the stratosphere through the ultraviolet rays that are absorbed by ozone. Greenhouse gases, in contrast, warm the troposphere, and they warm it most at the bottom where their concentration is greatest. At the moment, Earth is experiencing both stratospheric cooling due to the ozone hole and tropospheric warming due to increased greenhouse gases. This discovery has led to a reevaluation of some climate shifts, of which the so-called medieval warm period is most famous. Ever since H.H. Lamb first wrote of that warmer England in Chaucer, which could grow its own grapes and make its own wine, the idea that the medieval Earth was 1 to 2 degrees centigrade warmer than today has hardly been questioned. It has, in fact, become something of a cause celeb for climate change skeptics, for they have used it to argue that the medieval warming could have had nothing to do with the burning of fossil fuels, thereby casting doubt on the link between greenhouse gases and increased temperature. Leaving this wonky logic aside, the apparent discrepancy was resolved when it was realized that stratospheric cooling influences circulation in the troposphere, thereby heating and cooling parts of the Earth in a complex, patchy manner. A survey of global temperature records from ice cores, tree rings, and lake deposits showed that, if anything, Earth was then overall slightly cooler, 0.03 degrees centigrade, than in the early and mid-20th centuries, proving that the idea of a global medieval warm period is bunk. Greenhouse gases, orbital variations, and sunspots can all be thought of as forcing changes to the temperature of our planet. As scientists began to contemplate the influence of these forces and to look into the geological record to confirm how they worked in the past, they discovered that the fossil record is characterized by sudden shifts from one steady, long-lasting climate state to another. It was as if our planet had reacted in jolts to the factors that influence climate, and this series of wild shifts drove entire habitats from one end of the continent to another, causing many extinctions, yet keeping conditions within the bounds of tolerable life. And here ends the reading. Ha ha ha. But, I mean, we're talking science going back to 1660. And we still have morons out there that want to deny that this planet is getting warmer. And when you hear them say, well, back in the 70s you said we were headed for an ice age. Well, you dummy. Global warming leads to an ice age. I know that's a hard concept to get through your thick head. But once the warming and the CO2 concentrations get to a point, it's like smacking a lever. It then goes straight into an ice age. So when deniers try and doubters try and blur the argument and skew the argument, saying, oh, in the 70s, during the ice age, you say, that still stands. It still stands. But what we've learned is that this doesn't take centuries. When the switch gets flipped, it can happen in as short a time as 10 years, maybe even 2 years. And we're seeing signs of that, of us getting to that point. And the newest modeling is saying that we've got less than a decade to seriously. I mean, we're not talking these mediocre changes. We got to make some drastic changes, or else this entire society that we have, this entire planet, is really in trouble. It's in trouble now. And, you know, I have a quote from Mr. Flannery. I mean, and he's very right. You know, he doesn't mince words. You know, Australia's economic boom is pretty much driven by coal. All the coal that we sell to China. And it was only a couple months ago that he basically said that exporting coal is no longer acceptable for Australia. And this same thing applies to the United States, you know, West Virginia. He says it's no longer socially acceptable for Australia to keep exporting coal, knowing the damage it is doing. According to the scientist in Australia of the Year, Tim Flannery, Professor Flannery said that in the future, coal would be seen as just as dangerous as asbestos is now. As the situation unfolds and the matters get more critical, the world is not going to allow people to pollute our common atmosphere as it occurs at the moment, That was a quote from ABC Television, and there's a link there for the entire story. I think it's at the Sydney Morning Herald. And, you know, I really highly... I haven't even finished the book yet. I highly recommend this. The Weathermakers, Tim Flannery. It's fantastic. It's beautifully written. That is probably the trickiest bit that I've been through yet, because, you know, there's all kinds of funky old English and titles of documents that make almost no sense. But there's a lot in there. You know, the guy who came up with the formulas that we still use today for canon trajectories and actually also in audio, the Fourier transfer, is the guy who came up with that science for the greenhouse effect and the Earth's average temperature. You know, I mean, and 1660. It's still sinking in, and my head is not as thick as some others out there, and I'm still having trouble getting that through my little head. But I now understand why this gentleman was chosen as Australian of the Year, and I bet it's a little bit of a thorn in the side of the coal-loving government that we have at the moment. Because this is the kind of spokesman that we need right now. And when you're honored as the Australian of the Year, you get a lot of camera time. You get a lot of press time. And your research gets a lot of promotion. And, you know, you're invited to speak and all that kind of thing. So just, you know, in the way Al Gore has been going out and spreading the message, Tim Flannery spreading the message. I believe he's actually headed to the States here shortly, if I'm not mistaken. And you can find out more by going to the show post today at foxedup.headonradionetwork.com, or you can go to theweathermakers.com and read up on Mr. Flannery. He's got some action stuff there. He's even got, for those of you with kids, he's got the Weathermakers for Kids section of his website. I haven't had a chance to have a look at that, but, you know, since this is all, you know, dealing with the future, you know, just as we can teach all of our kids the bad stuff when they're young, we can teach them the good stuff too. So, you know, I think, you know, it's one of those things, get the kids to influence the parents. So, you know, yay Tim Flannery, and I'm going to probably end up devouring the rest of this book over the next week, and maybe we'll even, who knows, maybe we can even get him on for an interview. Maybe he'd entertain us with that kind of concept. And he's written a book on the North American climate as well. He is an explorer. I mean, this guy has been to all the corners of the globe studying, you know, the effects of climate change, you know, extinctions, you know, you name it. This guy's been all over it. And, yeah, so that's that. So, you know what? We got a track of the day, which I think we'll just I'll chew up some time, and maybe we'll just wrap up the show with that, Bob. And from Mr. Billy Shears, since we're taking Independence Day off, which is I think we should rename it. We should rename it to, you know, We Were Once a Free Nation Day. We Were Once a Democracy Day. Remember that? So Billy sent me a bit of Marvin Gaye, which I wasn't expecting, and I haven't actually had a chance to even listen to this. But I believe it's live, and it's Marvin Gaye, and we got a couple minutes yet before we get there. But you know, thanks to Mr. Billy Shears for that. you know, and so instead of the normal track that we play out with, we're going to play out with this, you know, in honor of Independence Day. You know, like I said, I think we should rename it. It's more kind of like a memorial to the free nation we once had. and by the way, some of the hosts here, and I know Bob's gotten a lot of this email about ways that, you know, you can help out the horn, and Bob will speak to this at great length, I reckon, on his show tonight. But if you are so inclined that you would like to contribute to this project, there is now a PayPal button on the front of the website. So, you know, if you feel so inclined, and those of you that have been actually writing in and begging for ways to and there have been a few. Have wanted to make a donation, please, we now have the facility for you to do so. Bob's telling me Bob's written a blog post about Scooter Libby and the judge in his case about revoking the probation. That would be kind of interesting. So, check that out. And you can probably find that at Op-Ed News as well. So, as usual, thanks to the Carpenters for everything that they do for us. Thanks to Bob for producing. Thanks to Ben Birch for the streaming and the archives. Thanks to the bloggers and our mods. You all rock. We're going to be off tomorrow. So, as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you on Thursday.
You're listening to KRML, 1410 AM, Carmel, California. The news from the Quality News Network is next.
This is the Quality News Network. In Pakistan, a soldier and a policeman along with two students have been killed during a violent standoff today between Pakistani security forces and armed students wanting Islamic Sharia law. President Musharraf has not raided the Red Mosque and enforced authority for free of reprisal suicide bomb attacks. British investigators are questioning at least eight people, six of whom are medical personnel in connection with the suspected Al-Qaeda plot to detonate car bombs in London and Scotland. In Australia, the BBC is reporting two doctors are being detained for questioning in connection with the failed plots, one while trying to leave the country. Neither has been arrested and no charges have been filed. London's Heathrow Airport Terminal 4 was evacuated today as security inspects what they are calling a suspicious bag. Authorities are keeping the threat level across Britain at critical, and passengers are undergoing secondary searches before being allowed to board outboard flights. Millions of holiday travelers can expect increased security during Independence Day week because of the attempted terrorist attacks in the UK. More than 41 million Americans will travel more than 50 miles from home this week, a new record for Independence Day travel. An estimated 4.7 million will fly in and out of U.S. airports. Congressional Democrats have criticized President Bush for commuting the prison sentence of the former aide to Vice President Cheney. Louis Scutalivi will not have to serve 30 months in prison for obstruction of justice, but will still have to pay the court-ordered $250,000 fine and serve a two-year probation. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's cabinet has approved a draft of a key oil law which will define distribution of the country's oil reserves. Debate could begin on its approval as soon as tomorrow. U.S. military forces killed at least 23 insurgents.